Hi, my name is Jen Mannion. I'm an associate professor of history at Amherst College, and I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to talk with James Alexander Dunn, author of Dangerous Neighbors, Making the Haitian Revolution in Early America, which was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Thanks for reading my book. I really appreciate it.
I'm thrilled to have the opportunity both to read it and to talk with you.
Yeah, it's great to talk with you, too. I'm a long-term admirer of your work, and we've obviously met each other before, too, but it's great to get a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, so I'd love to jump right in because I'm always curious about how historians identify their topic. And, you know, you say that, you know, between 1789 and 1804, the events in Saint-Domingue rocked the Atlantic world, right? So everyone at the time knew something was happening, and they were reading about it in the newspapers, but that this is something that historians have been slow to recognize. So I'd love to hear why you think this was an important story that needed to be told.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, well, from the sort of perspective of someone writing a book, it needed to be told because of the thing you just mentioned. You correctly observed that it was all over sources that I happened to be reading, newspapers and letters and such. Intense and continued attention and notice and discussion of these events that we, of course, you know, take as a Haitian revolution from our perspective, but at the time were current events. And it was apparently interesting current events because people were transfixed by them in the newly United States. So there's a certain basic kind of need to tell a story, I felt, because it was a story to them. And it was obviously more than that, too. It was something that they were not just reprinting and you know, bandying about, but actually discussing and incorporating into other elements, other issues that they were people of the time were interested in. So that was, you know, sort of the basic. It was the purloined letter kind of thing. It was this thing that was around in the records that I felt wasn't being discussed, or if it was being discussed, I mean, there are some historians who took it on, and even people writing in the 19th and early 20th century who took on the notice in the United States of the Haitian Revolution. But it was usually this sort of horror story alone. It was a very simple kind of tale of a collective American, and it's usually tacitly white, freak out of, you know, insurgent slaves and a black republic, and, you know, with varying degrees of you know, frankly, kind of racist takings of this place is a savage nation that's born in blood and this sort of thing. And there was obviously a whole lot more going on than that, too. So I wanted to tell those stories and really parse apart the way contemporary Americans, white and black, tried to make sense of these events as they took place. There's another maybe sort of more historiographic answer, I guess. And this is something I'm sure is familiar to you. And it's related, I guess. Historians, until very recently, didn't talk about the Haitian Revolution in the same sentences that they talked about the American, the French revolutions, let alone the Russian or the Chinese or the Iranian or, you know, anything. It wasn't part of that discussion. And I really feel like that is a vestige of that omission, is a vestige of maybe a Cold War kind of mentality where revolutions were meant to be, at least among Western historians, something to be recovered for their ideological probity and coherence. And, you know, it was part of a larger cultural project, maybe, to find a revolution that wasn't scary and radical, like, say, the Russian or the Chinese revolutions, or eventually the Iranian one. In other words, it could be a revolution that was, in some sense or another, conservative or progressive towards Western values. And if you're going to talk about revolutions that way, it gets very easy to leave the Haitian Revolution out. I think it's a flaw, but it's the case. You know, the famous R.R. Palmer book, The Age of Democratic Revolutions, doesn't mention it once. And so for me, now that we think about revolutions in a more nuanced and I think a more overt way, what the revolution's not as simply productions of ideas, or if they are in conversation with structures of, you know, material structures and interests and contingency and politics, you know, it's unavoidable to talk about this one that A, everyone was talking about at the time, and B, it had such a great impact in this Atlantic space. Sorry, that's a long first answer.
No, I love hearing about historiography, but I also wonder if historians were kind of caught up in some of the same anxieties that the white Philadelphians felt that you talk about. I think specifically Elizabeth Drinker, but also other people,
mm-hmm.
that, white Philadelphians felt anxious themselves about having, and maybe even ambivalent mm-hmm. and antagonistic, about having the memories of the American Revolution linked to the Haitian Revolution.
Yeah, I think that's...
And I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a degree among white audiences of anxiety, although I think I've found more nuance and ambivalence and even a degree of positive acceptance of black violence in among white receptors than folks have expected. There are the sort of not exactly voices in the wilderness who say, well, gosh, I thought all men were created equal. So these are just men who are, and now I'm referring specifically to the moments of slave violence, insurgent violence in Saint-Domingue, the French colony, Saint-Domingue. Saying, this is what happens, and that taps into a larger, vein of discussion about slavery in the 18th century. And again, this well, where rebellions, after all, are kind of things, a category of actions that slaves do that people have in their minds. They know that this is one of the things that happens when you have enslaved bodies of people, and this is just a really big and it turns out pretty long-lasting one, at least at the start, right? And so some of the same explanations for why slaves rebel get trotted out in as they watch this big one take place. Oh, this is what happens when you enslave men. Men naturally resist tyranny, and therefore, what's the cause of this insurrection? It's slavery, right? And then in response or the counterpoint is, no, this is slave insurrections happen because outsiders interfere with this institution of slavery that can be maintained in perpetuity unless people mess around with it, right? So there's lots and lots of white discourse floating out around slave violence. The kicker is it all gets wrapped into discussions, contemporary discussions about the French Revolution as well, and therefore about the relationship between a burgeoning republic based on natural rights and universal sort of humanity. As unfolding apparently, at least as of 1789 to say 92, 93 in France, and its most important colony, which is 1300 miles to the south. When all these different kinds of discussions get wrapped together, you find a great deal more ambiguity among, yes, Philadelphian, but also as sort of the more widespread American audience, that's reading Philadelphian newspapers and talking about France and Saint-Domingue in the same sentences they're talking about the need to resist Hamilton's conservative agenda and then Washington's seeming Anglophilia and these sorts of things. It gets interwoven into these other political discussions. And so there's ways that these folks, suggest degrees of acceptance, degrees of understanding, rationalization, even as they distance themselves from it and say that's what happens in a French place, they still see it as something that's rational and understandable in those terms.
Right. So you mentioned the newspapers, and they play a significant role in your book, and I'm wondering if you could just tell people a little bit more generally about newspapers in the early Republic.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and I'm standing on some wonderful shoulders here of scholars who have written about the important sort of vehicle for language and discourse and ideas that early American newspapers are. It's not too long ago that people discounted newspapers as any sort of evidence because they were so full of invective and they were so partisan and they were so full of hot air, really. And in fact, that's exactly what makes them so wonderful as sources and as ways to get a look onto not hard reported objective fact, right, but more political culture, print culture, writ large, the ways this polity was talking to itself as it formed. And I think there's an argument to be made that it really forms through newspapers. Americans had more newspapers than just about anywhere else in the world at this point, and we're growing newspapers at a faster rate than just about anywhere else. The early American polity, there's an act in 1792 that allows newspapers to circulate between post offices for free of charge. So newspapers just sort of flood around the early Republican. I think in the process of reading and reprinting and listening to newspapers read aloud, Americans really began to conceive themselves as Americans, as to sort of see an American identity in the process of reading and talking about the news. And again, I'm not the inventor of that notion. I'm standing on lots of scholars' shoulders there, thinking that through. But even as they're disagreeing vociferously about whatever they're reading about and the politics of the times and the moment, I think they're sort of constituting an American identity in that process.
Right.
And so, you know, what I decided to do was I happened to come to this project as I was also learning to use some database software, and I decided just to collect every mentioning of news from Saint-Domingue, the French colony that would eventually become Haiti, in Philadelphia. And at the back in that time, it was before digitization, so I was actually transcribing it all into this database, getting terrible carpal tunnel syndrome along the way, and sort of nausea from looking at microfilms and that sort of thing. So charting the way information moved became something I was able to do and sort of saw the utility of doing. And I could see how, news that would arrive in one port would circulate regionally through other newspapers. But as soon as it hit Philadelphia, which had the most newspapers and people remember is also the capital and is a really important commercial place, the news there would explode outward across the entire new nation and really take on a different kind of power and presence. So that's why I really sat the study in Philadelphia as a way of making a case for that information hub and the motor that those newspapers were for moving these ideas around out into people's, into their hands in the form of newspapers, then into their mouths and minds in terms of the language they used to talk about all this stuff.
Yeah, it's really exciting. You know, I think before I read newspapers from the period, I had assumptions that they would be provincial. And it's shocking when you find how much the news is about and from other colonies and other countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, there's so much more cosmopolitan and rich.
Yeah, yeah. And then they spread inward, too.
Today.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I mean, there's an assumption I feel like maybe when I was in grad school that people didn't print the news from the town they were in because, the assumption was everyone knows what's going on because they're still pretty small places. But even that seems to not be true to me. I mean, I see lots of things in Philadelphia being written in Philadelphia explaining what's going on in Philadelphia, let alone, as you suggested, just the wealth of information coming in from around the world. I mean, obviously, mostly from the West Indies and from Western Europe, but from other places too. We have to remember that this is before the telegraph. This is before, a moment when places far away from each other could really know about each other without a human body moving between them. The telegraph really changes that. Then it's an electric current thing. You can zap along a wire and someone can hear about something in another place that's far away. But before that, a human person, a body, has to move between the two places, right? And they're the ones who are going to bring their stories, the letters, the accounts, the newspapers from that other place. So for a place to know another place, people have to move between it, and the reason people are moving in the 18th century, for the most part, is to do business. And so that thing you just talked about, the cosmopolitanness, is also a measure of the commercial connection of,
right,
in this case, Philadelphia, but other places too, with various other spots around the world. And so, of course, Saint-Domingue was going to be a place they were interested in because Saint-Domingue was this gold mine for American grain sellers and merchants. It was where they made their fortunes. And it was the most successful colony, really, the world had known to that point. So, that was another sort of head-slapping moment. Why am I seeing this news so everywhere in the United States? Well, of course, because it's as if, the Silicon Valley seceded or something, or there was a rebellion there or something.
Right.
You know,
right.
Everyone's interested in what's going on in this important spot. So.
Yeah, wow. Well, I'd love to jump in more deeply then, specifically to the slave uprising in 1791. It seems like such an important turning point, not only in the island itself, but also Philadelphians and others who were following the news. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why that was such an important turning point.
Yeah, that's just right. I mean, it's as I just was suggesting, that it's really interested in this place, you know, leading up to that moment because it's so important and so, you know, commercially central. And then it just, you know, and there's moments of violence before the insurrections of 1791 between white factions over, you know, varying agendas of the French Revolution, and then there's it's a pretty interesting moment when the island's free people of color rise up, and there's some violence around their efforts to reverse some trends towards to try to reclaim the rights of citizenry once the French Revolution has gotten going. But without a doubt, the thing that really rivets Americans' attentions at this place that they're interested in is its spectacular destruction, which undoubtedly begins a new and important phase after August 1791. When, as I said, slaves had risen up around the world before. People understood that, but this never in this size. It's something like, you know, 2,000 at a single instance on August 22nd, and then within weeks it's 80,000, and it's not all at once. I mean, Saint-Domingue doesn't simply fold into slave violence. That's, I think, that idea is a vestige of our idea of the Haitian Revolution as simply slave violence. In fact, it's episodic. It ebbs and it flows. It's in different parts of the colony at different times. But without a doubt, there's definitely a trend from that moment onward towards, you know, this plantation society falling apart and falling away and transforming into something very different. So Americans are fascinated. They use it. They think about it in terms of this question of what makes slave insurrections happen. They wonder about it in terms of whether this is the result of, you know, sort of French ideas, these notions that. Of liberty and equality and fraternity are interfering with slave systems controls, or they talk about it in terms of this is, you know, part of a royalist conspiracy, or they, you know, talk about it in terms of the justice of black freedom struggles. That's certainly the way the distant voices, African-American voices that I've been able to witness receive it. So it's immensely useful and usable. By, you know, among a variety of American audiences, and they use it to great effect as they start talking about their own revolution and or continue to talk about their own revolution and what its legacy for the institution of slavery should or seems to be.
Right. So, you know, I think one of the ideas that you really complicate is the impact of the Haitian Revolution and you know, the successful slave uprising on ideas that white Americans were grappling with about the role of slavery in American society, and especially around, you know, what black freedom would look like and if black freedom necessarily also meant black equality and citizenship.
Right.
And so I'd love for you to hear more about how you found the nuance in this, because so often we just thought it was just more of a simple negative correlation that the revolution in Haiti in many ways caused Americans to just harden in their racist attitudes, that they had to do, you know, whatever they needed to do to maintain the social hierarchy.
Right.
And you show us that it's a more complicated picture than that.
Yeah, I'm glad. Thank you. I'm glad that's what you came away with, because that was certainly what I was going for. And it's not to say that hardened racial understanding doesn't happen. I just found that it was interesting to see how it happened and where it happened over time. For example, among white Southerners, or to the extent that I'm able to recover their responses, it's there from the outset. You know, it is there as part of the way that you understand a slave insurrection once it gets going. It's the interference on the part of outsiders, the thing I was just mentioning, that created this, because slaves need to be enslaved. You know, and it's a proof of their innate savagery, et cetera, et cetera. But looking elsewhere and looking in this thing, this discourse, as we talk about it, that newspapers give us a window onto, as you said, there's more fluidity, there's more flexibility, there's more nuance as people attach different particular moments of patient events, those that gambit for free colored, or as they're called, the free people of colors, gambit for civic equality, for example, gets attached to these questions. And you have people saying, well, it does seem to make sense that, you know, the rights of man should apply universally. After all, we here in Pennsylvania are moving in that direction, we think, you know, and are trying to, you know, end slavery gradually. And this is something that's happening in other parts of the newly United States as well. So it gets incorporated into discussions around those kinds of developments and can be made logical and can be made into something that sort of seems like it's a harbinger of future changes and things are going in the right direction. Which is not to say there aren't people saying, no, that's not right, that's incorrect. So, you know, as you say, it just adds another wrinkle and a degree of fluidity that I think it's useful to see, so we don't miss the eventual racial understanding and the hardened ideas about slavery, but we also see how they form and how they are political at their heart. You know, a big moment that moves us in that direction is when the emergent Jeffersonian Party is victorious in 1800, and at the same moment sort of pushes aside some of the more radical egalitarian ideas, at least the ones that were transracial, that it had bandied about in the earlier part of the 1790s, and makes the equality that they seem to stand for white equality alone. That's a big moment. And so seeing that, you understand the weight of that moment. You also see how things had been at least potentially different earlier on. I think above all, what you see by looking at all this is it's a birth of another kind of American exceptionalism. Early on in the early 1790s, people who thought American slavery was bad, white and black, thought that slavery, therefore, was a problem that the American Revolution and this new nation that it was creating was needed to solve, and needed to solve in a single way. There needed to be an American solution to this problem of slavery. And they make a gambit to do that. There's a series of petitions given to Congress. There's actions taken by abolitionists and abolition societies. And there's some hopes that, you know, that there's going to be a single sort of national, in their eyes, end to slavery. And what they learn in the course of that gambit, but also as news from Saint-Domingue percolates through American politics, is that there's not going to be a single American answer to the problem of slavery. There's going to be a variegated answer to the problem of American slavery. In some places, that answer is going to mean the gradual end of slavery, like in Pennsylvania and eventually in New York and New Jersey and much of New England. In other places, it's not. It's other places it's going to be an answer to the problem of slavery that allows slavery to endure, maybe done in some quote-unquote American and therefore some sort of good, you know, palatable, more humane way. But it's going to be as I said, variegated across the American polity versus having a single universal answer to the problem of slavery. That, too, is a development that I think we see better over time from my study. So it goes hand in hand with that hardened sensibility that you started off with in your question.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that I, you know, we see in the records of this time, even from white abolitionists, is there seems to often be a narrow path that free blacks or even enslaved African Americans can follow in order to make what is a palatable, seem to be reasonable case, right, for freedoms or expansion of rights. And if they're seen to go too far, and this is definitely the case in Pennsylvania, or if they are acting in a way that's too entitled, right, for freedom or an expansion of rights, then you often see a white backlash.
Right.
And I'm wondering if, and just to tie in, I wish listeners could see the cover of your book, and I encourage them to get your book and look at the cover for this image, because it's a very powerful image, and it's very evocative, and it suggests that ominous doom and
right.
great destruction
yep.
Result from black freedom.
Yep.
And
yep.
So I'd love to hear you reflect on that a little bit.
Well, I'm glad you like the cover. I do too. and it took me a long time to get it because it comes from an image in a museum in Bordeaux, and it took some doing to get them to agree to let me use it. And I wanted it because, yes, as you say, it evokes that sort of horrific, flame burdened sort of notion of what's going on there. But it isn't an imagined scene. It's meant to be painted from life or from an actual event versus, I mean, the listeners may be familiar with the lithographs or the 19th century images of the massacre of the slaves, you know, sort of imagined scenes from the waterfronts or the burning of plantations, which, are kind of, just that, imagined pictures that, that come from people's descriptions but don't have any sort of relationship to someone who actually saw it. Saw events on hand, whereas this is taken, reportedly seems to have been painted from an image from the decks of a ship. Right, it's looking out at an event that actually happened in June of 1793, and so I liked it for that because it was an image of this dangerous moment of violence, but it also suggested the vantage point I wanted, and also with all the smoke coming up, I thought sort of. The idea that this thing was wafting outward and was ready to be investigated and interacted with by people that would see that smoke. But you're absolutely right. The ultimate or the predominant sort of export here in that idea of Saint-Domingue is this notion that black freedom creates violence or can create violence, right? And say blacks living in Philadelphia at the time, we're very interested in pointing out the way that their freedom, for example, did not produce violence. And in fact, maybe even held off moments of violence, because
right.
they had been given, granted, taken, however you want to talk about it, a degree of freedom. They weren't full citizens, in many ways. But nor were they slaves, and slavery was being gradually, partially, haltingly, glacially being dispensed with, at least in Pennsylvania.
Right.
And so that's the way they, African American voices are always hard to get to in our period. I love the way you do it in your work, by the way, by looking at actions and the way they show up through white derived documents and such. That seems to me the best way to do it. But I do, I'm lucky to have one or two moments when African American leaders do sort of hint, like, we deplore the violence that's going on. I'm thinking of the famous pamphlet written by Absalom Jones and Richard Allen in the wake of the
right.
yellow fever epidemic of 1793, where most of what they're doing is fending off a charge being made that the blacks who helped with the nursing and the burying of the dead had taken money or shaken down their patients. They refute that, but then they stop, if you remember, and they write a separate piece in that compile pamphlet where they address slave owners, people who like slavery or approve of slavery, and say, look at all the violence that's taking place in Saint-Domingue. That's sort of a judgment on that society, like perhaps the yellow fever is. It's a providential sort of call for justice, and we don't like the violence that's being done by the slaves, nor do we like the violence that's being done on the slaves. You should, if you love your children, you should pay attention. White America. I think that's as close as anyone can get, really, to advocating or using Saint-Domingue in the African American community. Otherwise, it's a third rail.
Right. It's such a powerful pamphlet. I wish people were taught it in high school.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we're nearing the end of our time, but I wonder if we come to these projects, and sometimes by the time we get to the end, we realize things that we had not thought of at the start, or we kind of, it gets us to a new place in our understanding, either of our topic narrowly conceived or just of some of the broader strokes of history that we're engaged with. And I'm wondering what that might be for you.
Gosh, it's been so long that I worked on this book that what I thought at the beginning is opaque to me. But I think, what I've come to through this is a greater appreciation. in a way, for politics, but not high politics, but the politics of, or maybe better said, the contingencies of politics, how things, what we do as historians, I feel like, is we try to find patterns, we try to use the temporal perspective we have from standing so far away from our subjects to see patterns, to see, moments of continuity and moments of change. And as you know, as I was hinting, when we talked about earlier about the Cold War era, you know, there's various things that stand behind our efforts to make those patterns that have a lot to do with us, and maybe more than that has to do with our subjects. I don't know why, but I feel like our political moment is making us sift ever more finely for moments of contingency, of unintended consequences, of little moments of change that have reverberations and sort of urgent tug, producing urgent tugs in ways that people hadn't anticipated or even understood at the time. And so it's only fueled my sort of interest and my passion for sifting through these little moments with their big reverberations and trying to see how they all fit together in some way. I don't know what that says about me or us in the Trump era, but maybe it's I'm alone in my office too much, which is probably true. But it says something.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has really been great. I really appreciate your time.